Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. At any given time in the United States, upwards of 100,000 people are in some form of solitary confinement. Solitary confinement is everywhere in the United States today, in every part of the country. The average size of solitary cells are 6 by 10 feet. So if you visualize that, that's about a parking spot. The new book, 6x10, tells the stories of 13 people whose lives have been deeply impacted by solitary confinement. Journalist Mateo Hoke writes, quote, "This book, being about solitary confinement, is by its very nature about violence against the spirit as well as the body and mind. But at its heart, this is a book about America," end quote. Mateo Hoke is a writer, oral historian, mixed media journalist, and co-editor of the book, 6x10, Stories of Solitary. And Mateo joins us in studio. Hi, Mateo. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Wow. Thank you for writing this book. It was really intense to read. And I just want to point out that this is a Voice of Witness book. Mm-hmm. You have written another book for them called Palestine Speaks, Narratives of Life Under Occupation. And what I love this series, because what's so powerful is that there are all these books out about mass incarceration, and I'm glad they're out there. But what's so amazing about this is these are the voices of people who have been in solitary or people who have been affected by solitary.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the whole point of both books and of the book series itself is to hear from people who are directly impacted themselves. So it's not a journalist kind of taking and packaging their stories and their narratives. You're hearing directly from people.
How did you get involved in this project after your Palestine Speaks book?
Well, I knew I wanted my next project to be domestic after working for so many years in the Middle East on the Palestine Speaks book. And a very good friend of mine, Taylor Pendergrass, has more or less dedicated his life to reforming the carceral system. And so he and I got to talking many years ago about kind of the gaps in voices that people get to experience from those who are incarcerated, particularly those who are in the darkest corners of the prison system, right? So, as an attorney, Taylor works for the ACLU, and as an attorney, he, often just gets to share very small portions of people's stories, the most traumatic parts that are going to make the best voices in a lawsuit. And as journalists, we do that too, right? We often just pinpoint the most like affecting thing that we can get from someone. So we both felt like offering our readers and our audience the chance to really get to know people in an intimate three-dimensional way was going to be very powerful.
And how much did you know about solitary confinement before you started this project?
Well, like I said, I'm friends with Taylor, and Taylor doesn't really shut up about solitary confinement. So I knew a fair amount, but I learned a great, great deal over the 4 years it took to make this book.
And I love what you both did, sort of offering a 10-point primer on solitary confinement in the United States. Mm-hmm. And you offer just very basic facts. The first one is so important. Long-term solitary confinement meets the legal definition of torture. According to the UN, long-term solitary for more than 15 days constitutes torture and violates fundamental human rights.
Absolutely, and we're doing it every day in this country to 100,000 people at least.
So on any given day, there's about 100,000 people in solitary.
Correct, throughout the United States and all different types of facilities. So everything from juvenile detention, immigration detention, city, county jails, state and federal prisons.
So all over the country.
Every state, all 50 states. And that was one thing we really wanted to cover in the book as well, is we wanted voices from a wide geographical range, right? So we have narratives from Alaska, Florida, Connecticut, to California, and then all through the middle of the country, including like Michigan, Colorado, Arizona, Texas, Louisiana. I mean, it goes on.
And you write about how difficult it is just to interview people behind bars in general. How difficult is it to interview people who are in solitary?
It is more or less impossible. We did work with a law clinic at Yale to interview a gentleman who's incarcerated in Connecticut, who's kind of in and out of solitary. And then there's a number of people in the book who are incarcerated but weren't currently in solitary. But even that's difficult. I mean, you got to remember the system is designed to keep these stories hidden, right? Like prison officials don't want these stories coming out. And so they make it prohibitively difficult to get these stories. So we had to work around that as best we could.
You're right. Those in power do not want the stories of people in solitary getting out, so they make it extremely challenging to collect stories from individuals housed in isolation. It can be impossible to bring a recording device into facilities, even when meeting prisoners housed in general population. And when prisoners are in solitary, these difficulties multiply. In fact, most prisoners confined in solitary are not permitted visits at all, much less an opportunity for meaningful interviews. Many don't even get mail.
I mean, when you're in solitary, they are cutting you off, I mean, as much as they can. You know, it is extremely punitive in that way, and it's terribly damaging and traumatic.
All right. So, I mean, you interviewed 13 people. We'll get into some of their specifics. We're also later in the show going to hear from Heather Chapman, who's a mother in Florida fighting for the life of her son, Nico, who's been in and out of solitary for the last 6 years. He was diagnosed with bipolar disorder at age 10 and put into solitary at age 19. Give us some of the reasons why people are put into solitary confinement.
It can be anything. It can be because you looked at a guard cockeyed or the guard just didn't like you. It can be anything from fighting, you know, maybe it's violence, but often it's, you know, for what they call protective custody as well, right? So if you are considered a snitch or maybe you're trans, you can go into solitary because the prison doesn't have anywhere else to put you, right? So it can be a number of reasons. Often it's punitive, but it can also be for protection, so-called protection.
And the guard is the person that can make this decision?
Oh, yeah. Like a low-level male worker can make that decision if they see something in a letter that comes to you that they say is like a gang affiliation or a gang sign in a photo you get. You can go into solitary for very, very minor things. It's important to remember this is torture, right? Like this is a UN-defined torture method. So people are going in and being tortured for, you know, very, very minor, low-level things often.
And again, we're talking about a cell that is 6 by 9 feet. As you note in the book, it's about the size of an average parking space.
Yeah, or an elevator, bathroom.
An elevator. Yeah. Ah.
Like, there's a lot of ways you can imagine.
Because I'm reading the book, I'm trying to visualize this. Mm-hmm. And the elevator is brutal because we've all been in an elevator by ourselves where the doors close and you wonder, what if this thing gets stuck?
Yeah.
And that's what it's like for people for days, weeks, or even decades.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's you know, I'm not sure any of us can really understand, but it does help to kind of try and visualize yourself in a confined space for, you know, for a few days even. And, you know, you don't have your cell phone, okay? You might not have a book. You might not have, you know, a pad and paper, right? So there's all different levels of privileges that people have in different facilities and depending on how long they've been in there. But, you know, even if you're in there with just, you know, a book, Try to live in your bathroom for a week with just a book. You know, you're gonna feel things.
The other theme in the book that was really disturbing but so important to talk about is the trauma that so many of the people you interviewed deal with. The trauma before they even get to prison. And this is something that society doesn't really talk about in this country. Whether it's dealing with abuse at home, divorce, abusive siblings, I mean, major poverty. Can you talk about that? Because that just came up in almost every story.
Yeah, that was one of the things that stuck with me the most. I think that I learned most vividly was just how pervasive trauma is in our culture and in our society. You know, in our society, you know, difficult things, we often like to just hide them away and pretend they're not there, right? And so, you know, that's why a lot of people end up in the darkest corners of the prison system, because we don't want to deal with them. That's why, you know, a lot of people who are struggling with different mental illnesses end up in the prison system. Like, our society just doesn't want to deal with difficult things, you know, more often than not, really. And trauma childhood trauma is a major theme in this book, you know, and that's not something we set out to find. But, you know, when you just talk to people who are incarcerated, you start to realize, like, wow, this is extremely pervasive. Nearly everyone is coming from some sort of trauma, be it like horrific child abuse, community violence, you know, anything, right? Like it could be anything from family to community. Like, and there's studies that have been done on this that link childhood trauma to incarceration later in life. But when you realize that if you're coming from an extremely abusive household and you start to act out, and you don't want to be home, and you're maybe stealing because you're homeless, like, right? Like at age, you know, 12 or 14, which is multiple people in the book were dealing with that, you know, then you end up in a juvenile system that we heard over and over from people who are in the juvenile system that is just preparing you for incarceration later in life. It's not preparing you to live a big, full life. It's preparing you to just further your incarceration.
And there are so many amazing community organizations doing incredible work with very little resources, trying to reach these young people before they enter prison and enter this cycle. But especially right now, I mean, under this, you know, Trump administration, it's so hard for various groups to find the funding that they need. It's hard for people who work for these organizations to live in these communities, especially here in the Bay Area, because it's so difficult. Can you talk about the importance of that kind of work?
Just hearing from people in the book, right, the people that we interviewed, you know, some people did have some positive experiences with organizations like that at young ages, even kind of like not full on juvenile detention, but places that were court ordered for some of these people when they were young, when they were causing trouble at, you know, as like 12 or 14 year olds. They had positive experiences in there. But I think there's a lot going on socially now where people don't want to invest the resources in preventative kind of measures and care. And that's damaging for all of us. I think it's really important to remember that, you know, the trauma that happens in prison doesn't stay in prison, right? Upwards of 96% of people who go into prison come back out into our families and into our communities. And the traumas they're bringing with them, it comes back, right? You know, you don't know what the people in line next to you at the grocery store or at Target or, you know, at the park, you don't know what they're wrestling with, right? Because if they've come in straight out of solitary confinement, you know, they might not bear physical scars, but the panic of being around people, you know, the fear of getting in an elevator, like these traumas are pervasive in our culture and we don't always get to see it.
Today, we are speaking with journalist Mateo Hoke about the book 6x10, Stories from Solitary. Mateo and Taylor Pendergrass edited this book, and it's a book of stories of 13 people whose lives have been deeply impacted by solitary confinement. This book comes from Voice of Witness, an incredible organization that publishes a number of books that amplify unheard voices. It's a nonprofit. You can find more information at voiceofwitness.org. Mateo is also co-editor of Palestine Speaks, Narratives of Life Under Occupation. And if you have any questions for Mateo, if you or someone in your family or a loved one has been in the prison system, if you know anyone who's been in solitary and you'd like to share their story, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. At any given time in this country, more than 100,000 people are in some form of solitary confinement. We've done so many shows about the prison system in this country. 2.3 million people are behind bars, more than any other country in the world. And solitary confinement is in all parts of the system in this country. The average size of a cell is 6x10 feet. We can't talk about all 13 stories. So I wanted to ask you, because you spoke to these people, you worked on their stories, and it's hard to just pick one, I know. But, you know, if there is one that you'd like to talk about, one that maybe sticks with you when you go to bed at night, which one would you like to share?
Oh, wow, that's really tough. there's been quite a few that have, they all affected me. You know, I can't think about any of the interviews I did with people without feeling it. that's as real as I can be. I mean, these stories are raw, and people were very open with me. You know, I was very fortunate to build relationships with people where we got to go deep into their experiences before prison, right? Learning what they were like growing up and what their childhoods were like, and then, you know, what took them into the prison systems, and then once they were there, what took them into solitary confinement and the traumas they experienced there, the traumas they saw there. You know, I can definitely talk about like one chapter, but you know, one of the things that I think sticks out to me that haunts me is just how these themes show up in the book, mm-hmm. right? Like what people see in solitary, like the fact that, you know, I say in my introduction, you know, one of the things about this book is you're hearing from people who survived their solitary experience with their minds more or less intact and their bodies more or less intact, because a lot of people don't. A lot of people die in solitary, and a lot of people deteriorate to the point where meaningful interviews aren't going to be possible afterwards, right? And so I hear from people over and over while I'm doing these interviews over the last 4 years, like what they saw in solitary, the fact that, you know, people around them were just, you know, deteriorating mentally, spiritually, emotionally, on a daily basis, without help, without respite. And that looks like a lot of things. It looks like some very disturbing things that I might not get into on the radio here, but it's in the book.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, after the last week that we went through, in hearing from survivors telling their stories on the show for the first time and then reading about sexual trauma and violence in the book, I mean, it's intense.
Yeah.
I mean, this is so pervasive. I mean, the thing that also is amazing about this, so for every person that you interview, you have this beautiful photo of them that's been drawn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think almost all of them are smiling.
Yeah, the human spirit is strong, you know, and like I said, you know, the people in this book came out with their body, mind, and spirit more or less intact. So we're very lucky that they were willing to share those stories with us. And we're very excited to share these stories with our readers.
You say that some people don't make it out of solitary. Do these prisons keep track of this? And is this public information? I mean, can we find out, say, for example, in the state of California, where a lot of people are behind bars, does the public have the right to find out how many people have died in solitary confinement?
The prison systems often have their way of accounting for things that aren't necessarily truthful. Like you would be hard pressed to find someone on their death certificate say like they died from trauma from solitary. It would be high blood pressure or hypertension. You know, it would be all these physical effects that could be amplified by their time in solitary confinement. But, you know, you're not going to be able to draw a direct line. But yeah, people die, and you hear from the people who do make it out, like what actually went down inside.
Your book points out that when people spend time in solitary confinement, what happens is they have a really intense mental illness. I mean, in many cases, this is what happens. And it's not even solitary confinement, just in prison in general.
Yeah, I mean, look, if you go into the prison system presenting with any kind of mental illness, right, which a lot of people do, right? You know, mental illness often is kind of a natural reaction to a very sick culture in which, obviously, like, we're poisoning the very land with which we live on and need, right? So a lot of people who go into the prison system may present with some kind of mental illness. And when you can't immediately adjust to a violent, oppressive, pressure cooker-like situation, you might have an issue with a guard. If you have an issue with a guard, your punishment might be to go to solitary confinement, and you might need 90 days without a disciplinary infraction to get out of solitary. Well, if you're already struggling with some things, and maybe you're not medicated properly or mismedicated, you're going to have a very, very difficult time in solitary, not like banging on your door or trying to get someone's attention or trying to get help, which can all lead to more disciplinary infractions, another 90 days, another 90 days. And that's how people end up staying for weeks and years and months.
Let's talk about one of those stories. You write about, is it Vernicia?
Vernicia.
Vernicia Gordon. And in the short intro, you write, Vernicia Gordon has her hands full. She's a young mom of three and also works full-time at an elder care facility. She makes time to talk with us in the evenings while taking care of her small kids and often some of her two brothers' kids as well. She's age 25. She was interviewed in Anchorage, Alaska. And Vernicia shares her story in the book about how her partner, Davin Mosley, was imprisoned and how he was not able to, she was not able to contact him. Shortly after she was finally told that he could receive a visitor, she learned that he passed away. She was told he died of natural causes. At the funeral, she saw that he was severely injured. He had knots on his head, deep cuts from restraints, bruises, and marks from what looked like being dragged. Vernicia learned later that he had been denied medication for his schizophrenia and apparently had been punished with solitary for confronting an officer. Can you tell us more about this? Were you able to learn if he was denied medication for his schizophrenia?
I believe he was. That story is very, very difficult for me to talk about. I spent a lot of time interviewing Vernicia, and I got to meet her, I got to play with her kids, and those kids don't have a dad. Davon was killed in solitary confinement. They were shooting pepper spray at him while he's naked and very obviously mentally deteriorating in his cell. Why is he naked? Why are they pepper spraying him through the food slot in the door? I mean, Davon's story is just an embarrassment to that prison system, to that facility, to the people on duty, and anyone that is even remotely culpable. It's an embarrassment. It's a tragedy. He was definitely mismedicated or outright unmedicated for his bipolar disorder.
And Vernicia brought a lawsuit against the prison where he died. In her narrative, she says the Department of Corrections had to pay her family $625,000, but she doesn't know what kind of consequences, if any, the guards who abused Davon will face.
I don't think they ever faced anything.
And on the death certificate, it says he died of natural causes.
Oh, yeah. High blood pressure. Like an ulcer or something. Which is true. I mean, that is true, right? Like, he did die of internal injuries from the trauma of being in solitary. That's true. But what doesn't go into that is the beatings he took, why he was stripped naked, why he was dragged. Why he was pepper sprayed and abused like that.
Have any of these cases brought any kind of change? Or are they all individual and there's a payout and then...
The lawsuit in Alaska did force some change, some review, some policy kind of things, but no one was ever held accountable to my knowledge. Other narratives in the book, some people do come out of these situations and fight to make it better for the people they left behind inside. Sonia's narrative in the book, Sonia got involved with an organization in Dallas called the Trans Pride Initiative. She had been housed in a men's facility as a trans woman in Texas, and was put into solitary, quote unquote, for her own protection. When she got out, she did link up with an organization called the Trans Pride Initiative, and they helped implement some change around how the local jail deals with trans women.
Today we're speaking with journalist Mateo Hoke about the new book, 6x10, Stories from Solitary. It tells the stories of 13 people whose lives have been deeply impacted by solitary confinement. A solitary confinement cell is 6x10 feet. That's about a parking spot. And at any given time in this country, upwards of 100,000 people are in some form of solitary confinement. Some spend days, some spend weeks, some spend decades. And in many cases, they have nothing else with them in the cell. But in some cases, as Mateo points out, there's another human being in the cell. Sometimes they don't even know each other, and they're in this tiny cell together. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are joined by Mateo Hoch, a writer, oral historian, mixed media journalist, and co-editor of the new book, 6x10, Stories of Solitary. In the book, we meet 13 people whose lives have been deeply impacted by solitary confinement. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We have an email from Joe who writes, back in March, you did an episode on the effects of childhood trauma. Dr. Bessel van der Kolk's great book, The Body Keeps the Score, Brain, Mind, and Body in the Healing of Trauma, is a fantastic discussion of the long-term impact of trauma. This topic needs more attention across the board. Thank you, Joe. Definitely we'll check that out, and we'll continue to do shows about this important issue that deserves so much more attention. Let's hear from Sharon in San Francisco. Hi, Sharon. Welcome to the show.
Hi, and thank you very much for doing this show. And thanks to the gentleman who wrote the book. The reason that I'm calling is because I have had what I call the honor or blessing to be able to correspond with about 15 men who've been in solitary confinement in California. Some of them, the longest correspondent person, was in solitary for 34 years. And these are all men who have been leaders in the hunger strike in California that in many ways put the issue of solitary confinement on the national and international scale. And what I'd like to say is I certainly agree with the author in talking about the solitary is torture. There's no question about it. I'd also like to say that my experience, first of writing to men before they were allowed to make phone calls, they're now mostly in general population, and meeting some of them when I was able to visit, these men are the most honest and courageous and caring and patient and many brilliant human beings I've ever had the honor to know in my life, and I'm 81 years old, and I have several graduate degrees, but I've learned more from these gentlemen. What I used to say to them, what I do say is, they taught me to be a better human being. And that's a part of the communication around solitary that certainly the Department of Corrections in California does not want anybody to know.
Wow. Sharon, for people who are listening who might be interested in writing to people who are currently behind bars, how can they go about doing that?
Well, thank you for asking. I work with a volunteer organization. It's called Human Rights Pen Pals, and the website is www.humanrightspenpals.org, or they can email at the same at Gmail. And we are an Oakland, San Francisco organization. We're part of the Prisoner Hunger Strike Solidarity Coalition that supported, in whatever ways we could, the people who went on hunger strike beginning back in 2011. And we always are looking for people who have common values with brothers inside and can build long-term relationships of friendship and common values with. We work primarily, California's prisons are divided by alleged gender, so we are working with men. And it's a wonderful, wonderful life-transforming experience for anyone who would like to go through it.
Wow. Well, Sharon, thank you so much for calling in and sharing your story. Again, that website is humanrightspenpals.org, and we'll put a link at yourcallradio.org.
Yeah, it's worth noting that, you know, For people who are in solitary, just having that lifeline of someone to write to and someone writing to them, just knowing that they're not like completely forgotten about, for people that may not have family, it's hard to overstate the importance of that. You know, remember that most of these people will be coming back out to society, and feeling like society hasn't just thrown them away can make a big difference. Solitary Watch is another great organization to check out in terms of learning about this issue, following this issue, and connecting with this issue.
And as you said earlier, there are different rules for people in solitary. Some can have books, some can have mail, but others don't have access to these things?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people don't even get to go outside, right? Like, I mean, remember, you know, solitary confinement, we haven't really talked about what it looks like, but it's, you know, it's, yes, you're stuck in your cell, typically 23 hours a day. Typically, you're going to get 1 hour a day outside for what they call yard, which is exercise, but that's often just in another outdoor, like, cage, right? Like, imagine like a chain link kennel. So you're out there. And you know, that's what your days are like. 23 hours a day in your cell, 1 hour a day for maybe a shower and some yard time. But if you are, say, in upstate New York and your yard time is at 6 o'clock in the morning, you're not gonna get any extra clothes to go out and take your yard. You're gonna be in the same slippers you're in your cell. And so if you know, if there's a, you know, 18-inch snowdrift, you're out there in the same thin clothes for the entire hour. So effectively, it can be 24 hours a day in your cell. So wow. Having mail, having people to write to can make a big difference if the guards let it through.
If they let it through. The website, again, is humanrightspenpals.org. Thank you, Sharon. Today, we're joined by Mateo Hoke. He is co-editor of the new book, 6x10, Stories from Solitary. Now I would like to welcome Heather Chapman to the show. Heather Chapman is a mom in Florida fighting for the life of her son, Nico, who has been in and out of solitary confinement for the last 6 years. Nico was diagnosed with bipolar disorder at age 10 and put into solitary confinement at age 19. And Heather joins us from Fort Lauderdale. Hi, Heather. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. Hi, Mateo.
Hey, Heather.
Well, Heather,
how you doing?
Before we dive in and talk about mm-hmm. what you and your family have gone through, you know, so many people paint people behind bars with a broad brush, especially people who've been in solitary confinement. So can you just tell us a little bit about your son, Nico? What would you like us to know about him?
Well, that's kind of a hard question, but... You know, Nico is, he's like the kid next door, believe it or not. He's, of course, he's very handsome, very intelligent, and Nico could do anything. I mean, he would set his mind on, you know, one thing, and he wouldn't stop until he mastered it. He has a smile that literally lights up the room. A great sense of humor. Unfortunately, he's got, his feet smell horribly, but you know, he's not a monster. He's like, you know, he's just like the kid next door that happens to suffer with bipolar.
Mm.
And if I can just clear something up, Nico has been in solitary for the whole time. It's not in and out. He's been in solitary confinement. I think he did 16 days in open population, and the rest has been solitary confinement.
Wow. So solitary for 6 years?
Yes, over yeah.
6 years.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, Nico is your first child. He was born in September 1992. He began taking medication at age 10 for a range of mental mm-hmm. and emotional challenges.
Right.
And you told Mateo that when you first visited Nico in prison after he was sentenced, he'd already been in solitary for 2.5 years. He had been diagnosed mm-hmm. with bipolar disorder at 10. And when you saw him, you say you knew that you had 2 hours to save him. What was that first visit like for you?
Well, when a loved one goes to prison, you have to kind of apply for visitation. And So that's what happened. I applied for visitation. And as soon as my visitation was approved, they removed Nico's visitation. And so that's why it was 2.5 years before I could see him.
Wow.
So there was absolutely no contact for 2.5 years. Now, Nico was 19 when he was sent to prison. So the last time I had seen him was in court. And now I'm driving 6-7 hours to this prison. And it's called a special visit. They have it on death row. Nico's not on death row, but because it's a special visit, a no contact visit, it's on death row. And Nico's like in, locked in this little phone booth, and there's a divider glass between us. And the only reason why I was able to see him was Nico, because of the severe isolation, he started to deteriorate. You could take a healthy brain and put it into solitary confinement, and that healthy brain will deteriorate. So imagine if you are suffering with bipolar or some type of mental illness. You can only imagine. He started to deteriorate, and he just stopped eating, and he was dying, just laying there dying. I believe that's when the Palm Beach Post did a story on Nico. And because of that story, the prison system kind of woke up and went and found him and realized that he was near death. And they made him healthy enough to where I could come and visit. They actually called me and said, "Do you want to come and visit your son?" Which never happened. And so I said, "Of course." And when I went to visit Nico for the first time, he didn't know who I was. He couldn't make eye contact. He was 40 pounds underweight. He looked like a Holocaust victim. I couldn't touch him. I had this barrier, you know, separating us. This is my son, and I can clearly see that he's dying. So I had to get creative, and I had to use every bit of strength that I had to bring Nico back, back from basically death. And the first thing I knew I had to do was get him to make eye contact with me. Because he couldn't make eye contact. And so I would continually call his name and say his name and tell him to look at me. And I would call him, you know, I used to call him my, you know, Meeks, and just talk about when he was a little boy and talk about his sisters. And I just kept talking and talking, and I had a lot of energy, and I kept, you know, tapping on the glass and telling him to look at me. And I don't know how long it was. I don't know if it was 20 minutes or 45 minutes, but his eyes slowly went from the floor, slowly came up to my eyes. And when he locked eyes with me, you could see that he recognized me, and he said, "Mom, you're here." And I fell back into my chair and just, "Yes, Nico, I'm here. I'm here." And literally the color in his face started to come back. He was as white as a ghost, and he wasn't sure if it was me or if he was, you know, imagining it. And I said, "Nico, I'm really here. I'm here." And you know, once, you know, he realized that it was real and that I was there, then I just went to work. Mm. You know, this is what I need you to do. I need you to eat. I know that there's roaches and maggots in the food. I need you to pick them out. I need you to eat the food. And as soon as you eat your breakfast, I need you to do, you know, an exercise routine. And we went step by step each exercise that he would do. And we did the whole entire day. We mapped out his whole day, what he would do. First thing he would do is eat, and then he would exercise, and then he would write, and then he would read, and you know, then he would take a nap, and then at this time, and we did the whole entire day, and I just went over it and over it and over it, and I kept telling him how much he's loved, and how much we need him, and how important he is, and giving him life value. And
Heather,
in regard, yes.
Sorry to step in. I just wanted to ask you, you know, when you learn about what Nico has gone through trying to deal with his bipolar disorder, it says so much about how the system fails people. I mean, mm-hmm. he should not be in solitary right now. He should have received the help that he needed. And I think this is so important to point out. So Nico was diagnosed with bipolar disorder before he went to prison. And you told Mateo that the Social Security covered his medical costs, but when he turned 18, that stopped because he became an adult. And so you had to start the process of getting him covered all over again. He lost access to his medication. He lost access to his doctors. And then he started to self-medicate with oxycodone, and he became addicted to it.
Correct.
And he needed money to support his habit. And so he committed robberies. He robbed a Pizza Hut and a CVS. And as you pointed out, these were armed robberies. There were no bullets in the gun. Mm-hmm. And he did this to support his oxycodone habit, whereas what he wanted to do was actually get help.
Absolutely. Absolutely. He didn't want to be, you know, a drug addict. I don't think there's a drug addict alive that wants to be a drug addict. It's a very hard life. It's you just live for that drug. You're a slave to that drug. And when Nico's addiction was so out of control, this is hard. I have two younger daughters, and I'll never forget it. We were in the living room, and I sat Nico down, and I held his hand, and I said, "Nico, you know I love you, but you gotta leave because your addiction is more than I can handle or that you can handle." And there was no fighting or anything. Nico started to cry, and we hugged each other, and I told him the minute that he's ready to get help to call me. I don't care if it's 3 a.m. or whatever. Do you know that phone call came 2 days later? And we drove around actually for weeks trying to get him help, just to be turned away. And, you know, here in South Florida, at that time, was the only place in the country that there was no cap on this particular drug, the OxyContin. People used to come from all across the country, and they used to doctor shop. There were pill mills, and there would be lines around the corner. It didn't matter how old you were. It didn't matter what background you had. You know, there were people addicted from, you know, children to people in their 80s. I mean, it was horrible. Yet there's all this addiction, but there was no help. There was no detox. There was no program. You know, what there was, they were full all the time.
Wow.
and Nico did detox at home, but of course he relapsed, and shortly after that is when the robberies happened.
Mateo, you wanted to jump in?
Well, I think it's just worth noting that, you know, so many of the people in our society, when they do need help, you know, the services are not there. We're not a society that helps each other, right? We have this kind of cult of personal responsibility, which means if you make a mistake, whatever happens to you after that is your fault. Even if you were someone who's seeking help, whether it's drug addiction or mental health treatment, so many people end up in our prison system, and they're punished repeatedly and traumatized while they're in there. Like, when it could have easily gone a different direction if we had the help for people.
Exactly. And so, Heather, in your case, I mean, Nico was sentenced to 10 years mandatory minimum sentence in August 2012.
Yes. One of the worst days of my life, and Nico's as well. It came as a complete shock. We were told that he was going to be sentenced under the Youthful Offender Act. So the most time you can do is actually 6 years, but it's usually like 4 years in prison and you know, 2 years on paper, or 3 years in prison, 3 years on paper. You know, Nico committed a terrible crimes, and you know, he did have to pay for that, and he knew that, and he was willing, you know, and I knew that as well. So it's not that I was expecting a get out of jail free card, but I did have all of this documentation proving that he did suffer with bipolar and he needed to take medication. And the court, it's just the courts actually, they look down upon you. They, you know, if you have a mental illness, because they really don't know what it is, and they're scared of it, so they would prefer to lock you up.
Well, and can we also talk about the profit motive here, just briefly, Mateo? We've done a lot of shows about the drug companies, the Sackler family that has become—they've become billionaires off of these drugs, and then, of course, the prison system is just continues to explode, even in a democratically run state like California. I mean, we've done a lot of shows about the private prison industry, and again, we should say that the UN says solitary confinement amounts to torture.
Yeah, I mean, yes, yes, money is a part of this, absolutely, but it, really, this is a social failing.
Yeah.
You know, this isn't a failing just of the courts or just of the prisons. This is a social system failing. Like, until we all can kind of complicate our thinking around the fact that, yes, you know, Nico had no bullets in his gun. He's kind of a sympathetic character, but not everybody in this book is sympathetic, and that's why we wrote it, you know, because these issues are not easy, right? It does take complex thought. It does take complex empathy and emotions to really see this issue for what it is, right? And basically what it comes down to is, do we want to be a society that tortures people no matter what they've done? Like, and, you know, is that in line with our values? And that's a question I pose to our readers, right? Is this kind of torture in line with our values? Mm-hmm. Whether it's someone sympathetic like Nico, who was unmedicated bipolar kid who made a mistake, or if it's someone who makes a really horrible decision and hurts people in major ways. Like, what kind of society do we want to be? Because it's important to remember, like with Heather, you know, this trauma does not stay in prison. Mm. You know, Heather is living it every day with her kid locked up.
Mm-hmm. Right, Heather, you even told Mateo that this is torture for your family.
Well, absolutely, absolutely. It's something that Nico has almost died three times, and so close that I was literally thinking, how was I going to come up with the money to bury him for his funeral expenses? How was I going to get his body from the prison home? It is horrific. It has shaped my daughters. They've had to, you know, the things that they've had to endure. in our home and then go off to elementary school, like everything is, you know, wonderful. Yes, it's absolutely a nightmare. And yes, Nico will get out. And then what?
When is he scheduled to get out?
Nico's scheduled to get out in 2021. I believe November 2021.
And Heather, we're almost out of time. Is Nico mm-hmm. getting any help in prison?
I mean, this is, you know, we could do a whole show on this.
Right.
I mean, if I could just briefly, you know, explain. Nico is on a medical unit, but you have to understand that if they're on a medical unit, they're in solitary confinement, and there's not doctors and nurses walking around. Again, we turn to the, you know, the guard who's getting paid, you know, just above minimum wage. And he decides who goes to see the doctor and who doesn't. And that's how it's so easy to fall into where the brain and the body just shut down. Because you have just a regular guard walking past these solid door cells. If the inmate is not sitting up, dressed, with his bed made, bunk made, waiting for this guard to walk by, he doesn't go to see the doctor. And you go once every 6 weeks. There's no clocks or calendars or any. I mean, how do you even know when that is?
Yeah. So Heather, Nico is not getting the mental health help that you feel he needs. Is that correct?
Absolutely not. Yeah. No.
Well, Heather, we're unfortunately out of time, but we'd love to have you back. And I just thank you so much for sharing this story.
Mm-hmm.
Can I say? Well, I just want to thank Mateo. Mateo is absolutely a hero of mine, and I know so many other people, and because of his book and because of his hard work. And he did do a video about Nico one time that literally saved Nico's life. So I love you, Mateo, and thank you, Mateo.
Heather, I'll call you later.
Okay.
Heather Chapman is Nico's mom. She's living in Florida fighting for the life of her son. He has been in solitary confinement for over 6 years, and he will get out of prison in 2021. Mateo Hoke is author of 6x10 Stories of Solitary. If you are in the Bay Area, Nico will be speaking tonight at City Lights.
Mateo.
I'm sorry.
I'll be at City Lights tonight with Taylor, actually.
Taylor,
I'll take over.
Yeah,
Taylor's flying. Taylor's on a plane right now. He's coming. We're going to be at City Lights tonight at 7, and we're at UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism tomorrow at 6:30.
Thank you so much, Mateo.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for your work. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.